Hi, I'm Connor Cyrus, one of the hosts for Vermont Edition. I wanted to let you know that the podcast you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity. Thanks for listening and enjoy. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Connor Cyrus. On Saturday, a white man drove more than 200 miles from his hometown to a neighborhood in East Buffalo, New York, and opened fire in a Tops grocery store. 10 people died and 3 were injured. Officials say the violence was racially motivated. 11 of the victims are black and 2 are white. The attack is being investigated as a hate crime and an act of terrorism. This violence has left many BIPOC, that's black, indigenous, people of color, feeling unsafe, hunted, scared, and angry. Words we often hear after a mass shooting where BIPOC have been targeted. So as Vermonters grapple with the reality that these incidents can happen anywhere, we want to get a better understanding of what's being done to have everyone in the state feel included and safe. Later in the show, we're going to talk to two professionals who are having the tough conversations around diversity, equity, and inclusion in Vermont. But first, I want to welcome Tammy, who's live in the studio with me. She's a South Burlington resident from Buffalo neighborhood that was targeted in Saturday's attack. Tammy, welcome.
Thank you, Connor. Thank you, everyone at VPR, for having me here.
So I first just want to ask, how are you?
I'm still struggling to even answer that question. Right now I'm at sad and grieving and definitely scared.
How do you get through something like this? I mean, I feel like it's such a silly question because as Black people, we have to deal with this a lot, but how are you getting through it?
I'm trying to talk to people who can help me and support me through this. I'm holding my babies tighter at night. I'm doing this program is a big step for me. I really want to have conversations with people of color and people who aren't of color to be able to talk about this, because I think that's how we heal.
What's important for you to talk about when we have these conversations and, you know, in terms of your healing process?
I think walking into a conversation humble on both sides and recognizing that there's pain and there's some scarring and people might still be healing, respecting each other for where you're at. Like, if people are still angry, they are allowed to be, and they might not want to talk. And if people just have no reason to want to engage, that's fine too. But just to come with like a humble soul.
Now, as I mentioned in the intro, you're from Buffalo, from the same neighborhood where Tops grocery store is. Beyond that, what else is your connection to the city?
So Saturday afternoon, my mom, bless her heart, she's 80 years old. She's amazing. She called me at 3 o'clock, just hysterical that somebody had done something so horrific at Tops and we were still getting information. I was raised in that neighborhood, my church is literally around the corner. So that was a thing I couldn't get out of my head. My family lives in the suburbs, but my whole family lives there. And it was just, my mind was reeling. Also, my grandfather, he owned a ton of businesses on Jefferson Avenue, which is where that Tops is. He was a really big pillar of the community. He's 102. He's the oldest living black vet in Buffalo. And he was at that Tops opening because it was such a big deal to bring food and resources into the black community. I mean, you'd had to go to the corner store if you wanted to pick up something. So it was a monumental to build a chain grocery store in our community that we had access to. So that was a big deal. And it's just insane that that center of our community, or the black community in Buffalo, was attacked so viciously and so, it was very on
an act of terrorism, really.
Yes.
I mean, I think that's how I'm hearing a lot of people describe it, is just it was somebody that drove 200 miles to a black community and opened fire. How, when you talk to people at home that are experiencing this, that are living this head on, what, how do those conversations sound? I mean, how...
Well,
I just can't imagine. I just can't imagine calling somebody from home and just being like, "I am so sorry that you don't feel safe."
Yeah, exactly. I've talked to several people from home who still live there, and also folks who don't live there. I heard from, or who no longer live there, but were raised there, like me. It's a lot of silence on the phone because we're just so shocked. But then talking about all the, just, did you know so-and-so? And, oh, my gosh, remember Mrs. So-and-so from down the street? I got to check in with her and make sure that her children are okay, you know? So a lot of it was a lot of checking in. But it just felt like somebody came in my home and shot my family. That's what it felt like, because it was, it's so close, you know? And this, we think about terrorism and racism and as like something that's out there. And this just, it shook me and my family to the core. Even my father-in-law, who is a white man, he called me and he was, I could hear the sadness in his voice. And he was like, "It's like our backyard." I'm like, "I know." It just, yeah.
I can't imagine what you or anybody is going through. And Mike, and, you know, I just want to, like, give you a hug and just, you know, I want to tell you it's going to be okay, but too many times we know that, you know, it's this, something like this is probably going to happen again.
Yeah.
You said that your reaction to this horrific shooting was that there was so much you wanted to talk about, but so much you didn't know how to talk about. What conversations are being had that you can't or aren't talking about?
I think it really had a lot to do with my sadness around the responses and silence, non-responses I was getting. So I am from Buffalo, and in that neighborhood, I was raised in that neighborhood. But I got the privilege of going to an all-girls Catholic school, so which was predominantly white, and I have several friends from there, and I didn't hear from them about it. And I thought that was so strange, because I was, you live in Buffalo, and I know that they're white, and I understand that, but, like, the privilege of not having that news on your radar was, like, just so loud in my ears of silence, you know? It's not like I was sad and I was angry. I was just sad because it really hit home that, like, this was such a target to a black community that some of my white friends, people I love very dearly who love me, didn't even hear about it, or they did, and it just wasn't, it didn't make a connection to it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I want to talk about, you know, kind of the juxtaposition of conversations or lack of conversations that you're having. You said that, you know, when you were talking on the phone with a lot of your black friends, there was silence, and that silence was comforting, and that silence was okay.
Right.
But then to have silence with your white friends was not okay. And so I want to explore this and just have our listeners understand that being a present and silent is different than being silent, period.
Yes.
So can you talk a little bit about kind of your processing of this?
Yes. Thank you for bringing that up. Yeah, I guess I think having the silence but presence is a lot more wonderful and necessary and healing, because the act of getting in touch with me or being present or texting me or whatever, that was enough of a first step, you know, that anything after that, like if I didn't hear from you after that, that's okay. But not even reaching out, that hurt. But also, again, it hurt because of the everything surrounding it. Not that I was like, oh, so-and-so didn't call me or talk to me and I'm so angry. It just made me think, so-and-so didn't call me or talk to me because I don't think that they know either that this happened or that it would be such a wound for me, you know?
As somebody who's from Buffalo, but, you know, essentially extremely removed physically, and you live in Vermont, mm-hmm. and a lot of people think of Vermont as a very safe place. But yeah. Do you feel safe here?
That's a great question. You are the third person to ask me that this week. At first, I didn't have an answer. I have felt safe here. But that day, after that, someone asked me that, I was driving down Shelburne Road and there was a huge pickup truck and it had two huge flags on the back. And one was the American flag and the other one had an explicit word about Biden. I was shaken because this had just happened. I'm still reeling from it. And someone had just asked me if I feel safe. And then I'm driving down the road and all of a sudden in that instant, I did not feel safe. Not that person didn't say anything to me, didn't look at me. It didn't matter. They said enough. And I just have been driving around town like I feel like a target is on my back because I'm black. I have Buffalo stuff all over my car. I have children with me most of the time. So I am very, very fearful now. And it's just a shame because I moved here to find solace, you know? So
it's tough when you are trying to find that and something as triggering as a pickup truck can really rattle your sense of safety and security. I mean, I know and I think a lot of BIPOC in the state feel the same way, that you see a pickup truck that maybe just revs its engine in front of you and all of a sudden your safety is just instantly taken away.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I hate admitting it, but I don't feel safe. But I'm going to keep doing me, keep living my life, because I think if I live in that fear, if I choose to dwell there, I won't be able to move on and heal as much as I think I could.
For the rest of the show, we're going to be talking about people doing the work to foster diversity, equity, and inclusion in Vermont. What are your thoughts on that right now? Big question and a little bit of time.
That's okay. I did my homework. Producer asked me that yesterday, and I said I really want to think about it, and I thought about it all night. I think Vermonters, all of us, we just need to remain educated. I've been seeing a lot of things online about redlining in cities, and that had a lot to do with the black community in Buffalo, redlining. Educate yourself on that. What is redlining? I could talk about it, but I feel like people need to look into it. I also think don't be dismissive to folks about their experiences. Even if it's not as heavy as this, just let people express how they're feeling to you. I think it's an honor and a privilege to be able to witness someone's pain and be a support for them. And something I talk to a lot of my white friends about is, you know what, just if you have a question or you want to talk about race or privilege or anything along those lines and you don't know how to start it, say, hey, you know what, I'm struggling. I want to talk to you about this. I don't know if I'm invited to. You can say no, but I just want you to know I'm struggling to communicate and I want to understand what's going on. And my fourth thing is redos are okay. We all are human. We all make mistakes. Someone's going to say something that might be triggering or microaggression. And if you're coming from a good place, I would say go back to that person sometime. Be like, hey, you know what? That conversation we had, I really messed up and I'm sorry. Can we talk about it a little bit more? You know, so I think we can get there. I really do.
Let's hope so. And let's really just try to encourage conversations like the one we're having right now. Mm-hmm. Tammy's a mother in South Burlington, and as we've been discussing, she's from the East Buffalo community targeted by white supremacist violence last Saturday. Tammy, thank you so much for being so open, honest, and sharing your story with us.
Thank you, Connor. Thank you, everyone.
This hour, we're talking about diversity, equity, and inclusion in Vermont. Last year, Governor Phil Scott declared the second week in May Inclusion Week, a way to proclaim, quote, "The state of Vermont formally condemns discrimination in all of its forms and welcomes all people who want to live and work and add richness to our state, regardless of race, color, religion, national origin, sex, gender identity, or expression." The proclamation adds, it's a way to emphasize the ongoing work people are doing in the state to make it more a more inviting place. So now we're going to discuss what diversity, equity, and inclusion means, as well as get a better understanding of how cities and towns are adopting a declaration of inclusion, a grassroots effort to encourage cities and towns to be welcoming to everyone. We just heard from Tammy, a South Burlington resident from the Buffalo neighborhood where that shooting took place. I want to turn our attention to Vermonters who are guiding people in the work when it comes to DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. First up, we have Al Wakefield, the leader of the Vermont Declaration Inclusion Initiative, a grassroots effort, as I just mentioned, working with community leaders to reinforce the message Vermont is a safe and welcoming place for all. Al, welcome back to Vermont Edition.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here, Connor. Thanks so much.
Now, Al, I'm going to start with a really tough question for you. Initial thoughts, is Vermont a safe and welcoming place for people of color?
I think, depending upon who you speak with, yes. I've been here now 35 years. I came here welcomed by a Black man who owned one of the best restaurants in the state, if not in the country. But I also decided to talk to three other white people. One fellow who happened to start Killington, Press Smith. I spoke with a guy who had a major realty shop in Rutland, Frank Punderson, and a friend who was a weekend friend, Otto Yanantoni, who owned a large retail establishment. They were white. And I asked them about that, and I got answers that from all of them, yes. And I came here, so I've had great experiences here, and would recruit anybody to Vermont as someone who's lived in various places around the country and traveled fairly extensively. I know that Vermont's not a perfect place, but it's better than a hell of a lot of other places.
Al, we're going to continue that conversation. We're going to continue talking about that. But before we do, I want to also bring in another voice. I want to welcome Mary Gannon. She's a racial equity consultant, educator, and community organizer. Mary, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hey, Connor. Hey, Al. Nice to be here. Thanks.
And full disclosure for the listeners, Mary has been working with VPR and Vermont PBS in its DEI efforts. And listeners, you can join the conversation. What are your thoughts about what happened in Buffalo? How can Vermont and Vermonters do a better job of being inclusive? And what are you doing to promote DEI work in your community? Give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. You can also email us at vermontedition@vpr.org or tweet us at vermontedition. Now, Al, I'll start with you. Actually, no, I'll start with Mary because we just heard from Al. Mary, I'm going to start with you. In Buffalo, New York, 10 people were killed and 3 were injured at a grocery store right outside of the downtown area, as we just heard Tammy's accounts of that. When you hear about these racially motivated incidents that happen across the country, do you have the same reaction every time?
Thanks for that. I do have the same reaction. And I thought about it a lot this weekend when that news broke. And I was observing myself and thinking about the number of times when I hear these stories and sort of the personal reaction, but also just in my work professionally, what it means for me. And I want to say, just to situate where I'm at in this conversation, because folks can't see me, that I identify as a white person who has been engaged in this work for a long time. So absolutely. And I will say that this incident for me, particularly the first thoughts that I went to, because I have friends and you know, people whom I know who live in that community. So for me, it was very personal. It became a question of where are folks, who is safe, you know, trying to think in my mind where people might be during that time. And I will say, I also started to think a lot about what does this mean for our communities in Vermont, for Northern New England, because it's clear to me that this can happen anywhere.
Certainly something extremely terrifying and becoming a little too real. Now, Al, what are your reactions, and do you have the same reaction as a Black person when you hear about these events? Is it the same reaction every time?
Yes, pretty much the same reaction. Look, if it happens in Buffalo, it can happen in Burlington, it can happen in Rutland, Vermont, it can happen in Zurich, Switzerland. This kind of thing is a pandemic. And as a Black person, yeah, you're constantly aware of your Blackness, regardless of how confident you are about yourself and whatever it is you've done. You don't run around in fear, or at least I certainly don't, but you're very much aware of your surroundings at all times. So, yeah, Buffalo, when Tammy spoke, I carry that on two planes. One is intellectual. Yeah, that can happen. Be careful. Let's work where you are to try and make Vermont better, which is what Bob Harnish and Norm Cohen and I are doing. But also watch where you're going, watch who's around you. But I do that in Rutland, Vermont. I do that around the state. And I do that if I'm in New York City or San Francisco. That's just one of the loads that you carry being Black. But you don't walk around in fear. You are just, you recognize that that this is a zone. And you need to be careful in your zone about who's looking at you and who's around you.
But that heightened self of awareness comes from fear. I mean, regardless of what we call it now as adults, as a coping mechanism, that is fear, right, Al?
I don't count it as fear. No, I just count it as being aware of who you are and where you are. If I walked around afraid, hey, I wouldn't be in the streets. I certainly wouldn't be in Vermont. I'd stay home. You can't walk around in fear. I just personally don't have that. There may be people who do, who have fear. I personally don't. And I certainly wouldn't be doing this work on inclusion if I were concerned about who's going to dislike me, who's going to hate me, who's going to shoot at me, who's going to try and run me off the road, all of those things which might happen.
And listeners, we also want to hear from you. But before we go to the phones, Mary, I want to ask you a question. You talked about being a white woman in this space, and I think an insight that a lot of BIPOC don't get in these conversations are the conversations that happen in all white spaces. So can you first just tell us a little bit about how conversations sound in white spaces and how they differ from when a BIPOC person is present?
Sure. Happy to share some of that. And I just want to say out front, as I was listening to Tammy sharing her story and really sharing on a personal level, I just want to acknowledge what it means for her and for Al and for other members of our BIPOC global majority community in Vermont who have to keep telling us the impact of racism and white supremacy on their daily lives, right? So, I mean, this is one of the ways that we as white folks are able to understand, and we also need to do work on by ourselves in white spaces, and sometimes we call those white affinity spaces. And I will tell you that one of my big takeaways, Connor, right now, as I think about what I've been talking with folks about across the state, is this idea of fear and what white people are afraid of. When we sit together, and this is one of the things we talk about, like we will talk with each other about the fear that we have of engaging in these conversations. And some of that is about making a mistake or offending someone. And I think what's so important is that we, as folks who are positioned with white privilege, who are in a culture that is set up to serve us, that we need to deconstruct that fear and understand that there is a real cost to that. Because what the fear does for us, and we talk about this in white spaces, is it silences, it forces us to be silent. It allows us to be silent and to not engage in the conversations that we need to be having with each other as white folks, so that we're calling each other in, that we are examining how we have been socialized to understand that we have been taught to believe that we have this white privilege that many, many folks don't want to let go of, or not even fully aware of that.
And that awareness but that we also, is super important, yeah. right? And so as we talk about that, I do want to also hear from a couple people who we have on the line. Let's go to Chris in Northfield. Chris, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thank you. I'm actually calling from a Tops parking lot in Northfield. I just wanted to tell a little bit, like a story about how people who come to visit my home, which is a fledgling kind of farm hospitality business. The first thing they say to me when they arrive is about a sign, which is at the bottom of my road, which I pass every day. And I'm getting worked up just talking about it because it's really affected my mental health, having to drive by this sign on my way home every day. It's underneath a expletive Joe Biden flag and a don't tread on me flag. And it says, it's about 5 by 5 feet and says in red spray paint, trespassers will be shot in the face. And I wanted to speak up about it. But I had to think twice about speaking up about it via Front Porch Forum, because I was afraid of retribution. I was afraid that I could be shot in the face. And I also worry that if I were to speak up and try to take some sort of civil action, that the courts would just say that this is free speech. And I want to know if the state can do something about signs like this, because it can't be free speech when it is putting other people in a state of duress, because then they are not free. They are not free to speak up. They are not free to live their lives in the way that they want. It is, the irony of it to me is just disgusting, because
thank you for your call. And I'm so sorry that you have to drive past that every day. Mary, I want to go to you as somebody who works in an affinity space and worked with several mm-hmm. legislatures. Is there legislation or policies that can be put in place to prevent this kind of fear-mongering free speech?
Well, I didn't ask that question correctly,
but if you can answer that, that'd be great.
No. That's good, Connor. And just to be, you know, super clear, I'm not. I work. I am fortunate to be part of the Social Equity Caucus, which Al and I are both members of that group, and so I sit on that Social Equity Caucus as a community member and an advocate and organizer. So I'm not in the legislative space, and I'm learning a lot about it this year. I will say that there has been significant effort on the part of our legislators to really look at the way that legislation is getting crafted and policies are being put forward through a racial equity lens, and also looking at ways that the state has neglected indigenous communities and other BIPOC communities for, you know, hundreds of years. So I couldn't drill into specifics around that. I think that there is good effort around that. But Chris, the other thing I would say to you around your, you know, dilemma is, you know, yes, that is scary. And I think Front Porch Forum, if I were in your shoes, would not be a way that I would communicate about that. I think part of it is like really thinking strategically about how do we build relationships with people who come from a range of different perspectives than our own. And that's another thing we talk about in white spaces. You know, my work as a white person is to think about how I can reach to people who I have already decided, other white folks who have nothing in common with me, when in fact there might be some ways that they have felt marginalized. And so, you know, I think for us as white people, there's a lot of work that we can be doing within our own community spaces. You know, it's interesting. I was listening to something yesterday by Resma Menakem, who wrote an amazing book, if folks haven't seen it or heard of it, called My Grandmother's Hands. He is a man of color, is doing incredible work out in Minnesota and across the state. And one of the things that he said on his Instagram feed was, you know, this white folks, this is your culture that is broken, not ours. And that really resonates for me, because our work around white supremacy and systemic racism is within white communities, and how we help each other understand what we can do to dismantle that.
I want to go to the back to the phones, and I want to talk to Rachel in Cambridge. Rachel, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I wanted to chime in about an experience that I had. I am a private educator. I'm a white woman. Let me put that out there first. And not originally from Vermont. But I currently work as a private educator, mostly with homeschoolers. And at the in the fall of 2020, I wanted to kind of do what I could, activism through education, and offer a literature circle class for homeschoolers that was focused on BIPOC history and experiences. And I heard from a couple of people in Vermont who felt very passionately that I should not be teaching those classes because I am a white woman. And I don't feel that way. I feel that all educators should be teaching BIPOC history because, well, for one reason, there's not a whole lot of BIPOC people in this state, and it's not very fair to put all of that education on their shoulders. And as your speaker just said, the white culture has a lot of work to do within our own culture, and I was trying to do that. But I was shut down and I stepped away from teaching the classes so that I could sort of process the whole experience. And I just wanted to share that experience and hear what you all have to say about it.
Rachel, thank you so much for that call. I wanted to take that to Al. Al, when you talk to educators and community leaders about teaching BIPOC history and teaching people about the work of DEI, how can white people, I guess, accurately and appropriately do that work as teachers?
Well, that's, yeah, I guess I'm not talking to teachers. We're talking to towns and city managers and members of select board. That's a very narrow initiative at this point in time. And so we are not talking to school boards, although some school boards have signed on to the Declaration of Inclusion as written, as well as some churches. But we're not talking about that. In fact, I stay away from that because it's just not directly related to what we are trying to achieve. My own personal answer is that I think if somebody has a knowledge of that subject, regardless of their color, or their race or their background or anything else, they ought to be allowed to teach it, period. If they are an expert in whatever that area is, if they are knowledgeable, then they ought to be able to do that. I have no biases around who can teach what and who can't teach what because they don't happen to be of that gender or of that race or of that religion, etc.
Let's go back to the phone.
Can I jump in on that one?
Absolutely. Yes.
Just very quickly, I absolutely agree with Al. I mean, I think, if we want to talk about BIPOC history or the history of other peoples, I would say that's all of our history. So what we need to be looking at, I think, in education is, what is the history that is being taught? What is the real story about the founding of our country? The legacy of slavery, the impact on all of us because of some of the decisions that were made 600 years ago in the founding of this country. And I would go as far as saying that if there are white educators who are educating themselves around what it means to be white and bringing these stories and history lessons and curriculum forward, even better because we're modeling for our white kids as well about how to engage with these really difficult topics.
If I can ride in a little bit on what Mary just said, I grew up between Harlem, New York, Columbia, South Carolina. Columbia, South Carolina, as we all know, is a member of the Confederacy. In my all-black high school, we studied the history of South Carolina, which was a little blue book of 150 or so pages or so. I can tell you 83 years later that book contained 5 pages on the Civil War. And I can also tell you it is not the history of the Civil War as you, Connor, or you, Mary, or anybody else that's listening knows is accurate.
Now, Kim emails us and says, as a white woman living in Vermont in a rural area, I'm sad they don't have a more diverse community. I feel the lack of courage in our leadership to find ways to put an end to this hatred is very sad and painful. I wish I knew what to do to help and promote change. So, Al, I want to go to you as somebody who fosters the Declaration of Inclusion that many cities and towns across the state have taken up. What can leadership do to promote change and diversity?
Well, as of yesterday, there's some 49 towns and cities, plus a couple of other organizations that have adopted the Declaration of Inclusion. And once adoption occurs, we help them with the thinking on how they implement policies, programs, procedures, et cetera. And so that's moving along. And we've been successful because there are only three of us working on this. As I mentioned, Bob Harnish, who really started this, and Norm Cohen, who joined after I joined three of us to get this moving along. We've counted on partners like the Vermont Chamber of Commerce, the Vermont League of Cities and Towns, the NAACP in the Rutland area, the Social Equity Caucus that Mary mentioned, the Vermont Interfaith Action Group. And so we are working with them to help multiply, if you will, the effort to get this done sooner as opposed to later. And so for anybody who's interested, certainly please give me a call, al@wakefield-global.com. You can post that on your website if you'd like, Connor. I'd be pleased to speak with anybody about how they can help us work with towns and others in the community to propagate the Declaration of Inclusion.
Now, Mary, schools and communities play a big role in education when it comes to DEI work. You are somebody, when we talked to the other day, that said that, you know, you really want to talk about education and the school system. So why is it an important place to start DEI work?
I think that schools are essential because it's where we can start with children and at a very young age, right? Like, we can begin looking at how we have these conversations, how we look at our curriculum, how we are also training and preparing teachers to engage in conversations or bring forward curriculum that they might not be familiar with. So, you know, just at the core value of public education, I really believe that schools can be and are already in many places, you know, are a central place for this. Like, as a sphere of influence, have incredible impact and influence. One of the things that I have been observing in my work for a couple of years, and I think it's it just needs to be said, is when I work in school districts and schools, usually the folks who I like to start with are the people who are really in positions of power, who are really holding leadership in schools, superintendents, principals, school boards. So if I get a call, or my colleagues and I get an invitation to come because something has happened in terms of harassment and bullying, what we typically say is we need to talk with the folks who are messaging how school culture is being built. And those are the folks at the top. So I feel like what we need to see more of, and I would like to see more of, is really courageous leadership on the part of white folks who are in those positions of power in bringing forward, a full equity framework or an equity lens, as we like to talk about it.
Speaking of people and power
to school districts and
I just want to, I caught you at a good time. I want to segue to another guest. I want to bring on Representative Coach Kevin Christie from Hartford, who has been doing the work, and he's, and I want to hear more of his story. So, Coach Christie, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Hi, Connor, and Al, and Mary.
So, Coach Christie, as somebody who's been on the select board and has been integral in changing how Hartford High School views DEI work, what do you think are the most important steps for schools to take?
Well, as Mary said, I think it's critical that it starts at the top and the behavior is modeled by the leadership, because then it makes it much more comfortable for teachers and other members of the school community to continue to do this work.
And then, we know that Winooski just recently did an equity audit and Hartford did an equity audit. How did that audit change how Hartford moves forward?
Well, I'll be honest, it really didn't, because we've been doing this work for about 5 years. So we've been intentionally working in the direction of diversity, equity, and inclusion. We have a formal policy in place on race and equity. That policy is about 2.5 years old. It was approved by the school board. It didn't come easy, but now that it's in place, it's a foundational framework that has catapulted our district to a place that I am very proud of. And I think that Mary, as an educator and one of the folks who has helped us along the way to develop this framework, would agree.
Coach, Representative Coach Kevin Christie, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. We are running short on time, and I do want to get to some of these calls. So thank you so much for joining us. And listeners that are on the phone, thank you so much for being patient with us. We're going to try to hear from some of y'all. So if I get to you, just try to keep it as short as possible so we can hear everybody. Let's go to Rob in Williston. Rob, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Thank you. I just want to build quickly on the responsibility of white people. And I actually want to call out white men, that white men need to understand their role in history in terms of holding power and making the rules and having power over instead of power with. We need to understand that history, and we need to understand how to change that history so that we can dismantle racism and actually have power with and share it with the BIPOC women, So that's one of the things I think white men need to start recognizing.
Rob, thank you so much for that call. And Al, I want to take that question to you. Like, how can we begin to foster change in communities?
Well, I think what Mary said and what the gentleman said, you've got to go to the power, I think, in those communities to bring about change. We, with the governor signing the proclamation, we thought that was a very powerful thing. We very much appreciated that. That's been very helpful. I actually think that the governor can do more. I think it's key not only to his moral progress, the moral progress in the state, but I think it's key to his economic struggle to keep Vermont economically viable and, in fact, to grow this state. And so he can do a lot more. Provide that leadership to other town managers, select boards, and just articulating this every time almost he opens his mouth, because it's so fundamentally important to the state's growth to do that. And certainly leaders in communities, which is the way we've been successful in propagating the Declaration, can continue to publicize their welcoming. The fact that they want people to come to stay, that they will be safe in their communities. This has to do with posting things on bulletin boards, on memoranda, on mail that they send out to their constituents, and making sure that as they recruit, that they include people of color, that their policies support what they are doing in bringing in people of diverse backgrounds and implementing programs in their towns. And on our website, vtdeclarationofinclusion.org, in fact, we list ways in which towns and people can assist in this initiative.
Let's go to John in Stratford. John, we just have a few minutes, so I hope you can keep it quick.
Okay, thanks, Connor. I was involved in the civil rights movement as a young man in the 60s. The thing that struck me was the deep faith and spirituality that was involved. The songs and as a follower of Dr. King, and think that it can't just be laws. It has to be a change in heart and a change in consciousness. And that's a focus that's some ways a lot harder, but some ways really makes the lasting change.
John, thank you so much for that call. Mary, I want to ask, because we just have a few minutes left, what are good resources for people to go to that want to do the work?
Yeah, such an important question. You know, one of the things that's pretty fantastic about Vermont around this body of work is there is no lack of resources. There is no lack of community organizations. There are, you know, we have academic settings, and like in higher ed where some of these conversations are happening and where education can happen. I can do a few couple of quick shout outs. One is Rights and Democracy that I'm engaged with, an amazing organization. It's a bi-state Vermont, New Hampshire that's doing right now a series called Race Class Academy, looking at the intersections of race and class and trying to build that multiracial coalition. And I think really it can go into communities, like in community spaces. I know in churches, that's happening. So there's, you know, certainly you can reach out to myself and to Al and others who on the website, I believe, Al, right, there's a bunch of resources there. So the good news is there's no lack of them. But we have got to figure out as white folks, how we are going to engage, because silence is, I believe, is another form of the terrorism that we're talking about.
Absolutely. And let's go to Al to give you the last word, Al. Any important resources that we can put on our website for our listeners to go to, or that they can go to now if they are by a computer or otherwise?
I certainly encourage people to read the guidance that we've provided at VT, declarationofinclusion.org. But, you know, we've been doing some work through Abundant Sun that is working on the corporate side, but also working on the municipality side as well. I think Tabitha Moore and Kia Morris and several women who have been very, very prominent in Vermont have formed a consulting group and very, very knowledgeable. Certainly the Vermont Partnership for Fairness and Equity under Curtis Reed down in Brattleboro, been around a long time, knows Vermont. Those are all viable and reputable resources.
I want to thank my guests today for joining our show. We had Al Wakefield, the leader of the Vermont Declaration of Inclusion Initiative, a grassroots effort working with community leaders to reinforce the message Vermont is a safe and welcoming place. Al, once again, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for dealing with this very, very important subject, Connor.
Absolutely. And we also have Mary Gannon. She's an equity consultant and educator. Mary, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much, Connor. Take good care.